On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Satirist and humorist P.J. O'Rourke is a funny guy from the political right, acerbic, edgy, a laugh-out-loud conservative. In ancient days, he wrote for National Lampoon and Rolling Stone. Now he writes for the Weekly Standard. In between came books including Republican Party Reptile, Parliament of Whores, and Give War a Chance. Now P.J. O'Rourke is out with a book on a book, the O'Rourke take on Adam Smith's towering classic, The Wealth of Nations. In 1776, when a young America was declaring independence, Adam Smith was drawing the invisible hand of the market. Now O'Rourke takes up the pen. Up next on Point, P.J. O'Rourke on freedom, free markets, Paris Hilton, and Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. Joining me now in the studio is P.J. O'Rourke, humorist, satirist, and best-selling author of 10 books, including Modern Manners, Parliament of Whores, Give War a Chance, Eat the Rich, and The CEO on the Sofa. His new book, titled On the Wealth of Nations, is getting serious as part of the Books That Changed the World series from Atlantic Monthly Press. P.J. O'Rourke, great to have you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Also joining us this hour from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, good to have you, my friend.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. O'Rourke.
Hey, Jack. How are you?
Good, thank you.
P.J. O'Rourke, satirist, humorist, and now bringing Adam Smith to the masses. How'd they rope you in on this one, P.J.?
I was broke. It's the usual story of writers. This threw me into the deep end of the intellectual pool where I am not accustomed to swim. I was in London. I was talking to the Grove Atlantic's has got a UK branch headed by a guy named Toby Mundy, and Toby had this idea to do a kind of Cliff Notes for grown-ups. He would take the great big books that have changed people's minds, books that changed the world, and he would get somebody to write, you know, not a condensation of them, but a commentary on each of them. And he asked me if I would do the Wealth of Nations. And I had, about 10 years ago, I wrote a book called Eat the Rich, about where I was trying to figure out why some countries are rich and other countries are poor. And I had to teach myself a certain amount about economics, and I thought I'd read The Wealth of Nations. Well, of course, I'd read about 3% of it, as it turned out.
Like any of us, or practically all of us, if we've touched it at all. It's a great tome. The fickle finger of fate came to you in part, no doubt, because of your politics. You're famously sort of sympathetic to the conservative end of the spectrum of Adam Smith's thinking himself.
I am a free market guy, although whether that was wise on Toby's on Toby's part to choose a free market guy to write about The Wealth of Nations, I'm not sure. Because The Wealth of Nations converted me in a funny sort of way. I had been a free market guy primarily from a nuts and bolts, a practical standpoint. I could see in the world that free markets generated far more wealth and a general higher standard of living than centrally controlled economies did. I hadn't regarded it primarily as a moral question. Adam Smith converted me to a moral point of view on free markets that I don't know. I mean, I suppose I had it, but I think I didn't. My faith was not as deep as it is now.
And now, P.J., take us back to the man and the moment. 1776, this comes out, a rather famous date in American history as well.
Nice coincidence.
And maybe, you know, sort of at the end of that long, long period of time when one man could write a book sort of about everything. Adam Smith bringing together so many strands here. Remind us of who he was and what he set out to do with The Wealth of Nations.
He was a professor of moral philosophy at Glasgow University first, and he had been a private tutor for a while. But he worked for some 10 years on The Wealth of Nations, and it was only one part of a massive three-part philosophical project that he had undertaken. Project essentially to better the world. This is a sign of 18th century optimism that you can undertake a project to better the world. You know, and nowadays I said it sounds pretty laughable for anyone nowadays, at least anyone who doesn't wear Birkenstocks, but to try to better the whole world.
Still a lot of Birkenstocks out there.
There are, especially where I live in New Hampshire. So So if you think I'm talking about you, you people in Peterborough, New Hampshire, I am.
So Adam Smith sets out to save the world, but it does it in this volume by writing on economic philosophy.
He had the idea was to write three books. First was The Theory of Moral Sentiments, about how we make our moral judgments, how we come to moral judgments, how we can improve those moral judgments, how we can determine whether those moral judgments are indeed moral. Mm. A brilliant book, as a matter of fact, and a book that's necessary to read, and a big old doorstopper also, that's necessary to read before one reads The Wealth of Nations. Then there's Wealth of Nations, about how we can better our material circumstance. And he meant to write a third book on what he called jurisprudence, or we would call politics, about how to better our political circumstances. And that book never happened, partly because he died, but also partly because I think he ran up against a problem as a moral philosopher that it's politics, you know, not that much of a place for philosophy and no place for morals.
Mm-hmm. Parliament of Horrors, your phrase, after all. You go straight to the kind of tripartite, the three sort of fundamental pieces of Adam Smith's philosophy, the kind of where the rubber hits the road, even today, couldn't be more timely or in the news or in our own political debate. Take us to those three fundamentals.
Smith was the first person to clearly see that all economic growth is dependent upon three factors: pursuit of self-interest, division of labor, and freedom of trade. Now, what he meant by those three phrases and what we would mean by those three phrases is not exactly identical. Smith is, it is to be remembered, a moral philosopher, and he's talking about freedom. In pursuit of self-interest, he's not talking greed is good. He's talking about the fact that not only do we have, should we have the freedom to do what we want best as long as it doesn't harm others, but actually we have a moral obligation at a certain level to take care of ourselves and to take care of our loved ones, for the simple reason that a naked, starving, useless us is a burden upon the society. Mm-hmm. We have a kind of self-defined moral, not only a moral right to this kind of economic freedom, but indeed a moral duty.
Stand up, get to work.
Stand up and get to work. You know, to pull your pants up, turn your hat around, and get a job. The second point, division of labor, is not just specialization, but it's also our freedom to learn skills, to pursue the line of work that we want, to learn the things that we feel will be valuable to us, and then to produce goods and services according to the specialized knowledge that we acquire. Mm. And the third point is the freedom to exchange those goods and services that we produce with our specialized knowledge for the goods and services that other people produce with their specialized knowledge.
So Adam Smith lays out his three pieces in The Wealth of Nation. P.J. O'Rourke comes along, reads the 900 pages, brings it back to us. So it attuned you more to the philosophical piece of this. Did it change your own politics at all, sort of famously Tory, conservative leaning in the world of humor, where that's not so common these days? What was the imprint it left on you?
No, I wouldn't say it changed my politics, although my politics I am personally a very conservative person. My politics are not so much conservative as they are libertarian in this particular sense. I regard politics as a last desperate resort for the solution of any sort of human problem. I would sooner that we don't go to politics. They're sort of like, I regard politics as being a gun, basically. And of course, politics means nothing if the political system doesn't have the monopoly on lethal force. So politics, in a sense, does grow out of the barrel of the gun, as Chairman Mao was fond of saying. And so I don't think, you know, in your, say, the personal problems that you have, to make an analogy here, problems you're having with your kids, your pets, your spouse, your neighbors, you don't want to resort to the gun before you absolutely need to. And I feel the same way about politics. Do not resort to politics unless there's absolutely no other choice to be made.
Jack Beatty, you're reading over P.J. Rourke's shoulder as he reads over Adam Smith's shoulder. A lot of history with this book, a lot of waves sent through any number of centuries now by Adam Smith. What do you think of P.J. O'Rourke's take?
Well, I enjoyed reading it a lot, and I'm somebody else who's dipped in and out of The Wealth of Nations. and have both enjoyed it and found what you call his digressions just almost impossible to deal with. He had all the time in the world, and he wrote that way. But, you know, you mentioned 1776. Mm. There is that felicitous congruence, and yet the United States of America extensively ignored Adam Smith's teachings for the
Absolutely
next 150
true.
Years.
Absolutely
we
true.
Were the nation that basically said, Adam Smith, that's fine for Great Britain, and that's fine once Britain passes its corn laws. But, you know, you grew to greatness, Britain, through mercantilism, through managed trade. Mm. And now that you're on the top of the world, you want free trade. Well, maybe in 200 years, General Grant said, we can adopt free trade when we're on top. But we can't do that now. Now, instead of the invisible hand of the market ordaining what should happen with our industries, we're going to use what the Republican Party called the fostering hand of government. That is subsidies, tariffs, land grants to railroads, preferments of all kinds to build up our industrial base. And the result, of course, was that in 60 years, the country went from being an agricultural archity into a world industrial power.
Ooh, see,
behind
there I argue
these
with
behind
you.
These tariff walls. Now, some people argue it happened in spite of these tariff walls, but no one doubts that there is this embarrassing coincidence of our economic progress and our protectionism.
Jack's just pointing out that for a long time, the U.S. looked at that invisible hand and said, no thanks, we'll take the fostering hand.
Jack is absolutely right. The America's founding fathers were no students of Adam Smith, if they read him at all, and there isn't. I've encountered no evidence that they did. Alexander Hamilton was a strict mercantilist. However, to say that the United States grew rich by ignoring what Adam Smith was talking about is, I would say, post-hoc reasoning. There are a couple of factors that go on here. In the first place, Adam Smith was not proposing a strategy. He was simply trying to explain how things work. And America set up high trade barriers, but high trade barriers in a distant country with very high carrying costs of the late 18th century and the early 19th century meant very little. In many other respects, the United States followed, whether it meant to or not, the advice of Adam Smith, and it had no internal trade barriers. One of the things that Smith was very upset about, particularly in France. It had very few guild restrictions on who could undertake what specialization, what division of labor. Mm. There were very few taxes, and we did not mess with our internal economy, and we happened to have had a free market. It was an internal free market. The United States took advantage over the course of the 19th century in an immense internal free market. At a time when carrying costs were such that international trade between the United States and most other places was not nearly as important as it would become later when our transport was cheaper.
FedEx was not exactly flying in from Guangzhou every morning.
No, and it's very interesting that the Republican Party, which had long been in favor of high tariffs and of protection of American industry, two things are interesting here. One, when steam came along, when steamships came along and carrying costs began to go down, the Republicans began to get over their love of high tariffs pretty quickly. And the second thing is that the protectionist thing, which many people say, oh, that's what made America great, was this protectionist tariff barrier that allowed American industries to grow up. Let us not forget it also allowed the monopolies to grow up in America, so that by the time you get to the Gilded Age after the Civil War, you have a very nasty situation in the United States where a few big conglomerates and a few important financiers have astonishingly immoral degree of control over the American economy. And one of the reasons they were able to do that was they had the protection barriers of tariffs to hide behind.
Jack, what do you think? Were we big enough and far enough away from Europe, let's say, to have it both ways in the 19th century? A kind of Adam Smith-style freedom internally, even as there were tariff protections at the borders.
I think that's right. However, it's interesting that our path to industrialization was emulated in the post-war era by Japan. which is a small country, which doesn't, you know, didn't have these same internal economies.
That is, put up the tariff barriers and build your factories like crazy inside.
That's right. And essentially have a society devoted not to consumption but to production and to export. And Korea did a version of that. So it's striking that this path to development in these three major economies seems to have worked. And, of course, many people today think that the stress of the IMF and others on free trade has kicked away the ladder for developing economies, that they can't do what the United States and Japan did because the rest of the world essentially won't let them. They won't get any money. They won't get any loans and so on. And that, the case that free trade leads to development, there's evidence for it, but there's also evidence against it. And the basic position that the Americans took is, I think, one still valid. And it is that the wealth of nations, this is what this book is about, how the whole world would be better off with free trade, unquestionably true, but that the formula for the wealth of nations may not apply to a nation. And the Republican Party, for up to 1932, was concerned with the wealth of a nation. And they said, look, that's for a cosmopolite theory. We're thinking about this nation.
The USA.
And many people today are saying, wait a minute. Yes, this is true of the world. What about the wealth of this nation? Is free trade in our interest? And it's interesting, on this show we've had Paul Samuelson, the Nobel Prize winner and a developer of modern free trade theory, questioning it, wondering if it is still as valid as before, and wondering if trade with a country like China isn't in the end deleterious to our own social development.
P.J. O'Rourke, you've got the new book, Pull Away the Shawl of History, and bring up right up to date on trade then. But
Paul
put Adam
Samuelson
Smith in the room with
us.
You
know, I have actually read both The Wealth of Nations and Paul Samuelson's economics tech book. And I will tell
you.
Don't
get out much, P.J.
I don't. 900 pages of 18th century prose from Adam Smith is easier than Paul Samuelson's textbook.
But I'll tell you why. We've learned a lot about trade and through globalization and all the rest.
I don't want to hear Paul Samuelson's opinion about this stuff because Paul Samuelson is not, to me, adequately morally grounded in his economic philosophy.
Explain what you mean by that.
Adam Smith was talking first and foremost about liberty, about human liberty, about its, and without the material liberty, he held that we had no chance for individual liberty of any kind. Crucial to that individual liberty is the liberty to be left alone in our economic pursuits unless it can be shown that we are doing damage to our fellows, and I want specific proof. I don't want general theories. The reason that free trade is important is not because it aided in the development of Japan or didn't aid in the development of the United States or didn't aid. The Chinese would have a billion arguments against the idea that free trade doesn't help build an economy. It's none of that. Smith is talking about our individual freedom. What right does government have to come tell me that I can't buy a plush toy from China or that I can't sell them my wonderful karaoke rendition of I Walked the Line by Johnny Cash?
And yet it's called The Wealth of Nations. So what about the point? Does it work for a nation, for each nation, or is it really a kind of global welfare that Adam Smith wrote about?
Actually, Adam Smith is talking much more about our individual selves. He's looking for the answer to what makes a nation rich. And he shows the mechanics of this in his three points. But underlying message of the book is what makes a nation rich is freedom, and freedom and equality before the law. A situation in which we are free to do what we think best for ourselves, not just economically, but all across the board, where we are free from, to the maximum human possible degree, from interference by the forces that be, by power of any other kind, whether it's monopoly power or government power or military power or religious power. and where we are protected, where our property rights are protected by the law and our rights to that freedom are protected by the law. And let us not forget that the first and foremost property right is the deed we have to ourselves, our self-possession, our self-ownership, the fact that I have a right to me and the product of my. And Smith looks around and he says, if you look at the nations of the world that have become prosperous, he said, none of them are perfect. In fact, all of them are pretty bad. But those nations which best protect the liberty of their citizens are those nations that have prospered most.
We've got a lot on the table all the way from 1776 and Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations to right now in P.J. O'Rourke's On the Wealth of Nations. Jack Beattie is with us as well. You can join us, and a lot of people are waiting to. Let me begin to turn to listeners. Milton is calling, no less, from Northampton, Massachusetts. Hi, Milton. You're on the air.
Hi there. Glad to be talking to you.
Great to have you. What do you think, Milton?
Well, I'm a beneficiary of Adam Smith only through trickle-down, as I've never read him directly. I'm wondering if your speakers might address this issue of the natural tendency of wealth and power to accumulate into the hands of a few. Mr. O'Rourke did speak to the constraint of my efforts in my own self-interest by government and church and army and also by monopoly. And I wonder if we're stuck with a little bit of a paradox here that Bill Gates' freedom to express himself economically includes trying to corner the market on operating systems of computers all over the world.
And so
how do we address where the rubber meets the road? Or is this an ideology that needs to be balanced against other ideologies that, like mine, might be more idealistic?
PJ, what about it? Does Adam Smith's philosophy loop back around and step on its own tail there?
You cannot be more idealistic than Adam Smith. He was a moral philosopher. This is what he did for a living. And yet, at the same time, the Wealth of Nations is not an ideology. It is a description of how markets work. And to try and load the fact of how markets work with too much moral freight is to go argue with the bathroom scale. It would be nice if I could get on the bathroom and scale and say, you damn scale, how can you possibly say that I weigh 20 pounds more than I weighed a year ago? You are an evil, bad scale. Now, to back up for a minute to the question of cornering wealth, one thing that Smith points out in The Wealth of Nations, and it is a lesson that simply has gone nowhere in the past 231 years, is that wealth is not zero sum. At the time that we got our psychological ideas about wealth, which was when we were an agrarian people, or even maybe before when we were hunters and gatherers, wealth was zero sum. There's only so much land. If I have too much land, you can't have that land. The way I get rich is stealing land from you. Smith was pointing out, as early as the middle of the 18th century, that was long ago no longer true, that thanks to freedom to pursue self-interest, a division of labor and freedom of trade, more wealth could be produced. Almost none of the things that are vital to free human existence are zero sum. When we start to regard them as zero sum, it is down that road that leads to communism, to fascism, to the government of Burma, to the Osama bin Laden, and to the worst aspects of Nancy Pelosi.
But you were just pointing at the Gilded Age yourself and saying we got way out of whack here, and surely we've got an economy with a different structure than Adam Smith was able to see in 1776 or the 10 years before that that he was. Have we learned nothing about how this may be a little more complicated than he thought?
We have. No, actually, I don't think it is more complicated than he thought. At 900 pages, it's plenty complicated enough. Not that Adam Smith couldn't be wrong about things. His ideas of capital formation and his distinguishing between goods and services and stuff, he gets himself into various problems. But when you come down to the moral imperative to freedom, I don't think you can be wrong about that. I mean, either we are free and equal, decent human beings, or we are not free and equal, decent human beings. And if we are not free and equal, decent human beings, why aren't we, like, helping out the Taliban? You know, why shouldn't we just join up? Because that's basically their idea.
And yet you write that The Wealth of Nations, when it came out, was grit in the gears of Enlightenment thinking, and that something is still there grinding on our minds today.
Well, that first and foremost, that is the idea that we all have in our heart of hearts, that nobody gets any better off in the world without somehow hurting me. Anything anybody gets, it's the little brother concept. Anything anybody gets is somehow taken from me. But going back to the late 19th century and my complaint against monopolies in the United States, it was those monopolies in the United States were able to exercise their power because of connivance with government, because of government interference with individual human freedom. Other people were not free in the 19th century, not always free in the 19th century, to compete freely with the large monopolies, and they certainly weren't free to get their goods and services by importing them from overseas where they may have been cheaper. Well, services maybe not, but goods at any rate.
Though the maids came over.
I guess services were cheaper from overseas.
Jack, what about here? Milton says, wait a minute, maybe this loops around on itself and leaves the rich empowered in a way that tips the scales. PJ says, come on, freedom first.
Freedom first, but whose freedom, I think, is the question. And I think we've learned through our experience that the excessive freedom of the few, which can lead to monopoly either through government preferment or not, can actually sort of weigh down, can interfere with my freedom, with the freedom of the individual.
You're exactly right about this, but never forget that the excessive freedom of the few, which Adam Smith actually addresses in The Wealth of Nations, he said that all economic activities should be unregulated except when somebody's freedom impinges upon, does general harm to others. Never forget that the excessive freedom of the few is powerless without government assistance, without the monopoly on force that government particularly has. The few are able to coerce the many, but you have to have legal power on your side to do this, unless, of course, you're living in some sort of in Somalia where you can get a group of gunmen together and pay them. But that's not the society that we live in.
But we don't live in a libertarian utopia, and few do. It's almost, to be presumed that the rich can get that government help on their side.
It is. It is. And this is my continuing argument with liberals. Liberals are always saying we have to step in politically to keep Bill Gates from having this huge...
Don't step in, there's the government anyway. Witness President Bush's era.
What the liberals fail to understand, it is the government interference that allows the excessive power of wealth. And they intend to increase the power of government. Now, do they think that increased power of government won't be captured by the wealthy? Where do they think that Hillary Clinton gets her campaign contributions? Are they from poor people? Who are these wealthy, say the tort lawyers that back Democratic candidates?
Trent's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Trent. You're on the air.
Thanks. Yeah, I wanted to thank particularly PJ because he saved me from a tedious flight. I bought his book in an airport, and it kept the screaming brats at bay for a while as I read it.
Oh, boy.
You read it aloud to your children?
Oh,
you're a cruel man.
I was curious, though. I got a lot of insight from the era that Adam Smith was talking from your book, how people communicated, entertainment, the sort of the life Adam Smith led. How much research did you do into his life as opposed to just his writing?
Not nearly as much as into his life as into his ideas. For one thing, because he didn't really leave that much behind about his life. He didn't keep diaries. He was not a good letter writer. He often didn't keep the letters written to him. There's a lot we don't know about his life, which is probably fine because not an awful lot seemed to happen about his life. But I did kind of immerse myself in the world of 18th century Enlightenment thinking as best I could to try and get an idea of what the general atmosphere was there. And it was actually a very modern era in a lot of ways. I would say that it was a more modern way of thinking than what we get through most of the 19th century. It kind of comes around to it's an ironic, skeptical period without too much faith in the innate goodness of man.
Very skeptical about what would come to be called British imperialism.
It was skeptical about British imperialism. It was skeptical about organized religion. It was skeptical about the romantic idea of man's nature, skeptical about human beings being innately good or innately evil.
You write that it might give us pause at some moments about everything going on in Baghdad. What was Adam Smith's problem with the British Empire?
That it was badly run, and that it harmed the people that it sought to rule. That Smith wasn't against an empire per se. He's not a he comes from a pre-democratic era, but he could see that the rule of law was not equally applied to the people that the empire ruled. That is to say, that the Indians in India were not equal under the law to the British in India. He took India as being a worse example of the empire than the American colonies. He was very much in favor of the British pulling out of the American colonies, even though he didn't like us all that much. He thought that we were very selfish, that we'd let the British win the French and Indian War and had never paid a cent for it. And now that the British wanted to tax us, we were all in a lather about it. And he thought that was actually pretty funny. But he thought it was useless for the British to try and stay. And also, it was simply wrong that Americans would have different rights before the law, that is to say, lack of representation in Parliament, than the British at home.
Can you intuit an Adam Smith view of the war in Iraq?
I cannot. I really cannot. One can only go so far. You can't freight these things with too much. Adam Smith was very much against war. He considered them to be a huge waste of human resources. And yet, on the other hand, he was a brave and patriotic sort of person. He had seen the kind of chaos that he'd seen the last Highland revolt and the kind of chaos that can descend upon society in Scotland. And so he wouldn't have liked the feudal sort of structure of the of radical Islam very well at all. So. But further than that, I don't think one can safely go.
Let's go to Portsmouth, Virginia, and Sherry. Hi, Sherry. You're on the air with P.J. O'Rourke.
Hi, Tom. Hi, P.J.
Hi.
I find it curious that we can be talking about free trade and the founding of America and not talk about slavery, which was one of the foundation of free trade in America in terms of how we have been able to achieve this status as an economic leader.
Sure, right there in the middle of it in those years, yes?
Indeed. And so, I mean, and as we look at talking about this financial beginning of America, we have to also appreciate the legacy of that, because here we are in the 21st century with a number of Fortune 500 companies that got their start as a result of how they were able to define human beings as property and get a foot up, as they would say. And my question is, how do we apply the principles of free trade to where we are today? Here in Virginia, we deal with dealing with that history. This was a major stop in the Underground Railroad, and we want people to understand that the free trade and how we got started, democracy, all those things, were defined back then, and we've now got to try to get back to the original meaning of all of that, as opposed to kind of color coding our history through rose-colored glasses. We need
Sherry, that's great. Let us pick it up, if we may. No doubt, Adam Smith talked about slavery. It was
Smith
a big issue then. What about the slavery then and echoes now, Peter?
Smith was an eloquent anti-slavery person. But it's very interesting in reading The Theory of Moral Sentiments, his first book, and The Wealth of Nations. Theory of Moral Sentiments gets read very little today. If you pick up The Wealth of Nations, there's a very strong argument against slavery, but it seems a rather cold argument. It is an argument that slavery is economically inefficient, that while seeming to the work of slaves seems only to cost their maintenance is at a very low level. Smith points out that actually, to what extent slaves are motivated to indeed sabotage the efforts of their owners, and who could blame them one bit. Mm. But you think, yes, that's an argument against slavery, but
pretty
cold-blooded argument. Yeah. Well, that's because Smith assumed you'd read his previous book. And in The Theory of Moral Sentiments, there is an impassioned argument against slavery at the level that I was talking about earlier, at the mm-hmm. moral philosophy level of the first and foremost thing that we have to have, that God gives us and that man must grant us, is the deed to ourselves, the fact that we hold ourselves in our own hands and mm-hmm. our own ownership, and Smith was. Smith was there are no holds barred in the argument that the moral argument he made against. But you know, morals only carry us so far in the world, and I think in some ways more good has been done by practical realization. It was the British, I think, who first understood that slavery was a disastrous thing to introduce into a society from an economic point of view. Sadly, I wish I could say that the main force in the British anti-slavery movement was a recognition that this was morally wrong. But I think the thing that actually carried the ban in slavery and in the more important in the slave trade and sent the British Navy out to stop the slave trade, including the slave trade to the United States, was a far colder realization that this was an inefficient way to use the genius and the efforts of one's fellow human beings.
Jack, there's Adam Smith with the theory of moral sentiments, and then a kind of colder logic alongside as well. What do you make of Adam Smith as a moral guide today, Jack?
Well, I have read a lot in the theory of moral sentiments, and my gosh, that's a spectacular book. I mean, it's like reading, it is philosophy, and he gets right to the bottom of human motives and really reduces the motives for riches to something else, the motive to be noticed, to be taken account of, to be something in the world.
People
aren't greedy for its own sake. They're greedy for renown. And he's full of that. But, you know, this point about his being a moral philosopher is, I think, so true, it's truest of all, really, in his discussion of the division of labor. He sees it as a great advance. Everything depends on it. And yet his terse sentence on the human consequences of the division of labor compares with anything in Marx's whole chapter on the working day. Here's the sentence. The man whose whole life is spent in performing a few simple operations, of which the effects, too, are perhaps always the same, generally becomes as stupid and ignorant as it is possible for a human creature to become. But in every improved and civilized society, this is the state into which the laboring poor must necessarily fall, end quote. Must, because the increased productivity that lifted economic growth for the first time in history rested on that. Then he adds a caveat that I think makes him a progressive. He said, all this will happen, quote, unless government takes some pains to prevent it. That government has to act against the injustice of the division of labor, both certainly in manufacture, but even more so in industry, which cracks the whip of speed over manufacture and which deforms the human character because people have to keep doing the same thing. Charlie Chaplin, government has to take pains to prevent the worst of that.
PJ, Adam Smith as progressive.
Because that ignores what Adam Smith thought that the proper fix for the situation was, and he didn't think that it was all sorts of elaborate labor laws and Wagner Acts and so on. Not to say that he necessarily would have been against them. It's important to remember that Smith was not an absolutist. He was a nuanced man about a lot of things. But his cure for that aspect of division of labor was education. And it's an interesting approach he took to education. He essentially would have been in favor of voucher system. He was not in favor of fully free education. He thought education should be so inexpensive as to be available to the people of the most modest means within the society. But he did not feel it should be completely free, lest students get what they pay for, which is what I'm afraid they get in too many of our public educational systems today. But as you go through Adam Smith, you'll never find him making a statement with a sort of reckless absolutism. There's nothing of the Pol Pot in the guy. He says, for instance, you know, he carries on probably as eloquently as anybody ever has. He argues the case for free trade. And yet he talks about, you know, he was a customs inspector. He was a customs commissioner. But he also says that these laws, these trade barriers, must not be removed too swiftly, lest they cause terrible dislocation in people's lives. He was always aware, just as he was here in talking about specialization or division of labor, he was always aware of what the reality of people's lives were. He was not an insensitive person.
PJ, let me ask you, I was thinking about Adam Smith and your book yesterday, reading the newspapers. In the Times, Ben Stein's column was there, and of course Ben Stein has celebrated capitalism and free markets for a long time, but he's become kind of sour on what's happened with the American economy recently. And he was just sort of lamenting and raging it yesterday, saying, look, we've got outrageous, obscene CEO pay, greedy backdating of stock options, managers buying assets at pennies on the dollar away from shareholders, sort of corporate capitalism in trouble. He said, each day's newspaper, it seems, brings more tidings of unrestrained selfishness and self-dealing and rafts of powerful people saying it's good for us to be robbed if only we truly understood the system. The problem is, says this very pro-capitalist guy, we're coming to understand it all too well. Are the wheels somehow coming off the wagon? Adam Smith is sitting back there 231 years ago. Here's Ben Stein saying, oh, you know, wait a minute. Will capitalism last the way it's being treated?
Ben is, to me, I mean, I take his point. I think it all irks us. You know, it irks any of us who own stock, and in a weird sort of way through mutual funds and insurance companies. And so we all end up owning stock. Those of us who are tiny minority stockholders in some of these big corporations can't help but be irked by these pay raises. We get angry. But Ben is rolling several different problems together. I mean, let us not confound what appear to be unfair compensation with actions that are actually illegal. Now, obviously, actions that are illegal, if the government is in any way turning a blind eye to actions that are actually illegal, that is a serious jurist,
but he knows the difference. He is rolling them together and says how long a democratic capitalism can survive these blows before it gives in and gives birth to revolution or to out-and-out aristocracy, I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know. Again, I think he's who was it, Trollope, that said in his autobiography, said one of the reasons that journalism is always so strident, and of course, we're on radio, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
A little bit of stridency comes out on radio now and then, doesn't it? One of the reasons journalism is so strident is that if you give a man a hammer, he will hit things with it as hard as he can, you know, and I think Ben picked up a hammer and he's hitting things as hard as he can. It's always important to distinguish, you know, what is morally wrong from what is morally undesirable.
And if Smith sat here with us today looking out, if he could sort of take the view of the economy as it's unfolded, pleased at all the growth since he wrote and...
Unbelievably pleased, because I don't think we understand, unless we really sit down and think about it, what poverty meant in Smith's day versus what poverty means today. Well, not that there isn't poverty in the United States. That's pretty shocking that there aren't people that are in pretty desperate circumstances. But in Smith's day, we're talking about starvation. We are talking about people starving in the streets. And not, of course, just in England and Scotland were relatively prosperous places. Smith lived in a world, we talk about the number of people in the world, the billion people in the world that live for less than a dollar a day. He was probably talking about a world where there were an equivalent percentage of people living for less than a penny a day. I mean, he was born into a world that was ferociously poor. And the amount of economic progress that's been made for ordinary people from his time down to ours is astonishing. I wish that progress had been made in other fields as brilliantly as it has been made in a purely material field.
Yes, and he would have diagnosed, I think, some of the maladies that that Ben Stein was talking about, because he was a great critic of the corporation.
He was, indeed. He was vicious. He didn't like the corporation at all.
And the phrase he used is, the manager deals with other people's money, and that's a perpetual temptation to what he calls negligence and profusion. By gosh, that could be a text for any of the Tyco, any of these scandals. And negligence and profusion.
And then here, quoting PJ on Adam Smith, he said, if you want to have a war, raise taxes so that you pay for it within 1 year. You'll have many fewer wars.
Well, good point.
No question about that. PJ O'Rourke, the new book is on The Wealth of Nation. PJ, thank you very much for being
here. You're
with
very
us.
Welcome.
Jack Beatty, always great to have you. Thanks for being there.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.